हरे कृष्ण सो द ओकेजन ऑफ जन्माष्टमी लेट अस डिस्कस अबाउट द सिमिलैरिटीज एंड डिफरेंसेस बिटवीन द अपीयरेंसेस ऑफ द डिफरेंट मैनिफेस्टेशंस ऑफ द लॉर्ड एस्पेशली वी विल फोकस ऑन द मैनिफेस्टेशंस ऑफ कृष्णा एंड कंपेयर देम विद राम प्राइमरली and also with other incarnations to some extent. So the Bhagavad Gita 4.9, Krishna states, janma karma cha me devyam evam yo vetti tatvatah tetva deham punar janma naiti mameti so arjuna. So he says that those who know the appearance and know the transcendental divine nature of my appearance and activities, they become attracted to me. They don't come back to this world, but rather they come to me. So now the Lord's appearances are in various species. As Kunti Maharani says that Piryan Nara Vishishu Yadisu Tadatanta Loka Vidambanam in 1.8.29.30, he says that, oh Lord, you appear in the fish form, in the human form, as a sage, and tatatyanta vidambanam. In fact, in the 8th canto, in the last chapter of the 8th canto, that's pretty 6th chapter, it's called the Matsya Incarnation of the Lord. And there, Parikshit Maharaj asked Shukadeva Goswami that the fish form is not considered particularly auspicious. In fact, Jugupstam, it is considered inauspicious. Among the 8.4 million species, the fish is considered to be the lowest, lower even than the trees. There are many reasons for this. One of the main reasons is that the sun is considered to be the source of illumination. And although in terms of activity, the fish are more active than trees, but often fish live further away from the illumination of the sun than do trees. So he asks, why does the Lord appear in such a form? And then at that time Shukadeva Goswami reiterates the message that he had given earlier, that the Lord always remains transcendental no matter what form he appears in. So now usually when the Lord appears in non-human species, or rather we could use subhuman species, means species below the humans, at that time his appearances, the modes of his appearances are so extraordinary that it's difficult for us to even connect with them. That somebody say, for example, Varaha Dev, how does he appear? He appears from the nostril of Brahma. Now usually what comes out of the nostril is nothing special. We just, if something comes out of ours or other nostrils, you know, we just turn our face away and try to use a tissue paper or something to throw it away. But here, from that gateway from which usually valueless stuff comes out, the Lord comes from that, who is the Lord, who is a supremely valuable being. So there is. That means, when Krishna is saying janma karma cha me divyam, what he implies is that rather than focusing on the mode of the appearance, which can be bewildering, which can be shocking, which can be intriguing, which can be amazing, that variety will be there. But more important than that, more important than the mode of the appearance is the purpose of the appearance. How he appears is not as important as why he appears. So his purpose is to attract us, and thus even in ordinary seeming activities he does extraordinary things. He often gives some extraordinary twist to those ordinary seeming activities, and he appears. So for example, we have Narasimha Dev, who is half man half lion, who appears out of a pillar. Normally, you know, if we
broke a wall of a house or something like that. At the most, we might find some wall termites. If the house is made of wood, then some wooden termites, some insects which eat into wood, some ants which eat into wood might be there. Or some other insects might be there. Normally, not many big things live inside a wall or inside a pillar. And what to speak of a giant being like this? So in whatever form the Lord appears, it's extraordinary. But the real extraordinariness is not in the mode of appearance, it is in the purpose of appearance. So, now among His various manifestations, the most human-like are the appearances of Ram and Krishna. In fact, Jiva Goswami, or Rupa Goswami in the Lego Bhagavatamrita says that among all the various manifestations of the Lord, the intimate relationships are manifested most in the form of Krishna, and second after that in the forms of Ram and Narasimha. So Narasimha is a half human, half simian form, half leonine form. Leonine is tiger or tiger like or tiger and that family. So when we look at the appearance of Ram and Krishna, there are some similarities and there are some differences. First similarity is that both are appearing in Kshatriya dynasty. The Lord usually appears in the Kshatriya or the Brahmana dynasties. Of course, he appears even outside the human species. But if you look at various incarnations that are described in the Bhagavatam, many of those which appear in the human form appear in these two varnas. So, now both are appearing in the Kshatriya dynasties, and as we know that Ram appears in the Surya Vamsha and Krishna appears in the Chandra Vamsha. Normally speaking, some people ask, you know, what do you mean by Surya Vamsha and Chandra Vamsha? Is the idea that the dynasty descending from the sun or from the moon? Is it an intelligible idea? Sun and moon are celestial bodies, and people and how can an earthly dynasty be descending from them? The problem with asking such a question is that there is a presumption over there where there is no right answer that you can give. Say for example, if you ask a person, so have you stopped beating your wife? Now the question itself is a trap. If you say yes, that means you are admitting that you are beating your wife earlier. What a shameless person. And if you say no, then that means you are still beating your wife. So, here when people ask how can there be a dynasty coming from the sun or the moon, now there is a presumption. So such trick questions, rather than being answered directly, first we have to challenge, expose and counter the assumption underlying that question. And the assumption there is that the sun and the moon are nothing more than just some celestial objects. So nobody denies the sun and moon are celestial objects. But is that all that they are? The Vedic worldview describes that above that where modern science sees only the interactions of material objects according to the laws of nature governed by impersonal forces. There, the Vedic worldview sees the actions of consciousness. So that means that there is something higher. So there are celestial bodies, and the celestial bodies themselves will not give rise to dynasties. But the celestial bodies are ruled by higher being. And there is a pan-cosmic connectedness within the Vedic universal worldview. Pan-cosmic connectedness means that just like nowadays, we live in an interconnected world. And say today I go to the market and I feel that the cost of sabji is 25 rupees per kg, say some vegetable. And tomorrow I go and find the same vegetable is 45 rupees per kg. And then somebody may ask, what happened? Why is the price gets increased? Oh, there is a war in the Middle East. There was a war in the Middle East. Why did you have to increase prices for that? But the point is, in an interconnected world, a war in one place, a place which is the source of oil, might mean that the oil prices increase. Oil prices increase means transportation prices increase. And transportation prices increase means commodities prices increase. So the point is, one who understands the interconnectedness of things can appreciate, can make sense of the changes that happen. Otherwise, people will think the changes are arbitrary and unpredictable and senseless. So like that, just as a person who is educated in global economics can understand how one thing at one place can cause change at another place, similarly, one who is educated in the philosophy, in Jnana Chakshu, can understand how the universal population is not a result of merely unguided chance. That there is a brahma bhuvana loka punaravartin arjuna. That there is a commonality of characteristics that underlies all of material existence. And though for us, it may seem that the sun and the earth are separated by a large distance, but the Vedic worldview is such that yes, there is a distance, but underlying the separation of a distance, there is a commonality of purpose. And the commonality of purpose is that everywhere there are arrangements for the promotion, for the establishment of dharma and the promotion, the propagation of dharma. So, the same beings, the same purpose that is there for living beings on earth is there for the purpose of living beings on higher planets. In fact, those beings who are more evolved in consciousness than us, they make arrangements for creating similar systems on the earth. So just like now, if we come to know that there is some calamity in some distant part of the world, so if our country is relatively prosperous, then our country may say, America may send some food supplies, some relief, or even some troops to try to create order over there. So like that, the predominating deities of sun and moon, the sun, Surya and Chandra, are higher planets, and they arrange for life to be similarly organized according to principles of dharma on earth. And that's how they have their dynasties, which continue not only on the sun but also on the earth. So when we understand this significance of these dynasties, then we will also understand why the Lord appears in these dynasties. Essentially what he is doing is, he is coming to fulfill the same purpose for which he has actually set up the world, and he has set up the dynasties of the world leaders, of the universal leaders rather. So that is, the Lord appears in dynasties which are meant for establishing dharma. Evam parampara praptam imam raja rishayo viduhu. So in 4.3 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the Raja Rishis are actually establishing, learning and sharing spiritual knowledge. And that spiritual knowledge is actually meant to protect dharma. So now, this one commonality is there, but the difference is many. That Ram appears as the eldest son and Krishna appears as the youngest son in their respective families. So, of course, after Krishna, there has another younger son, younger sibling, that is Subhadra. But as far as the sons are concerned, Krishna is the youngest. Now at one level, whether a person is the first or the there is the first and there is the rest. That means the first will be the next successor after the king, and the rest will become assistants. In fact, that was one of the main reasons why Gandhari got very angry when her pregnancy got prolonged. she had hoped that her son will become the successor, but when she came to that Kunti had already got sons, then she was angry. So the point is that Krishna is appearing not as the first son, but as the last son, meant that by the principle of primogeniture, primogeniture means that in a royal succession, the eldest son will become the next king. So by his very appearance, by the point when he chose to appear, Krishna, in one sense, forfeited the right to rule. Whereas Ram, he was destined to rule. And that's why even today, when we talk about Ram and Krishna, we talk about Ram Rajya and we talk about Krishna Leela. We don't talk about Krishna Rajya. Why? Because Krishna never directly became a king. Of course, Krishna was not a king, but Krishna was the kingmaker. Kingmaker means he was the person who, by whose prowess and by whose skill, others became kings. So in that sense, Krishna was no insignificant person. Actually, Krishna's kingmaker role can be seen in two primary ways. One is that he enthroned Maharaj Ugrasen as the king, and second is that he enthroned Yudhishthir as the king. Yudhishthir pratishthata barhibarava tamsaka. In the Krishna Ashtodashaka Nama, it is stated that Yudhishthir pratishthata. Krishna offered the throne of the whole world to, offered the crown of the whole world to Yudhishthir, and for himself he took the simple crown of barhibarava tamsaka, of a peacock feather. Now, so this is one factor that Krishna, by appearing as the last son, forfeited the right to rule. Now, if you look further, Dashrath Maharaj, there is one characteristic of him is that his parents, they went through a lot of austerity in terms of doing very severe sacrifices to get a child. So the primary thing was that although Dashrath Maharaj had several queens, still somehow he couldn't get a child. And this can often be a heartbreaking thing for families where they just are not able to get children. So it's a very legitimate and deep concern, because it's a natural human urge to express our love to. And especially for a king, it also meant that he had to continue the succession, and he had to make sure that the kingdom was passed on to able heir. So usually, whether it is in India or in any traditional culture, it is considered the responsibility of a father to beget a heir and then to beget a spare. So the word spare might seem derogatory, but the idea is that it's understood that life here is unpredictable. So if there's a heir, a successor, but then something happens and that person becomes disabled or that person dies, then there has to be someone else who can take the succession. So that's a spare. So now, Dashrath Maharaj, the austerity that he had to perform was, he tried for a long time but did not get sons. Then finally he performed a very big sacrifice, and that's the whole story in the Ramayana, how that sacrifice also had to be performed with a particular person to be the priest, Rishyashringa. And getting that Rishyashringa was complex. So, and there was a different kind of trouble. It was a big amount of trouble with no certainty that there will be success at the end in terms of whether Rishyashringa will come for the Yajna or not. So that trouble was of one kind, where Dashrath Maharaj had to perform huge amount of, take up huge amount of anxiety to perform a sacrifice. Now when Krishna appeared, that time also his parents had to go through a big amount of austerity. Now in this particular analysis, we'll focus on the Bhagavatam's version of how Krishna appears in terms of Krishna as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. Later, we'll also discuss about how if Krishna, the son of Nanda and Nanda Yashoda,
Then we'll see how this analysis extends further. So here we come to so the austerity that Nanda and Vasudev had to perform, Vasudev and Devaki had to perform was of an entirely different kind. But in fact, it was much more terrifying. Right? They had to both live in the prison. They lived under constant fear of their own death or the death of their sons. And in that way, there's no guarantee that they will be able to have a son, or that their son will be actually live safely. So now we know that the appearance of Krishna, if we go in the back, you know, often there is a, whenever there is a story, there is a backstory. Backstory means, suppose if we start a novel with a particular point of action, or if we start, there is a movie in which the story starts at a particular point. And now to make sense of the story, if suppose a movie starts with, say, two people fighting with each other, and they are furious at each other and they are about to kill each other, and suddenly someone comes in between and tells them, "Oh, the two of you are brothers." Now, they thought they are mortal enemies and they are brothers. Now, at such a point, what is required is to make sense, how are you brothers? Then you have to go back and tell the story. There is what is called a flashback or backflash, or it's called a backstory. So, now there is a backstory to the appearance of both Krishna and Ram. And in the backstory, the important thing is both are descending to the world for divine purposes. Both are descending to fulfill the prophecies of gods. So like earlier I talked about the connectedness of the universe. So just like now, if one part of a country is say hit by terrorist attacks, so then at one point there is there seems to be ordinary life, and then suddenly there are terrorists who are wreaking havoc, and then suddenly after some time you may say that, oh, there is CRPF and there are this army and there are many policemen who are coming from various parts. So what has happened? At a superficial level, if you say, okay, there was no one here, how suddenly police have come? That is because, you know, that particular part of the country where terrorists have attacked, that part of the country is not disconnected from the rest of the country. So if the news goes to the central authorities that there is a terrorist attack over here, the central authorities will send forces from various places. So similarly, on earth, if there are demoniac forces who grab power, then they may think, now we have routed everyone else and we are in power. But the earth is one part of the whole universe. And so, there may be someone policeman who is wounded at a particular place, or who is just escaped from the terrorist area, that person may send SOS to the police headquarters. So like that, Bhumi Devi, when she sees the earth is overrun by demoniac forces, she goes and gives the SOS signal, save our soul signal, to the devatas. And devatas, and along with Brahma and Bhumi Devi, they go and appear, they try to deal with the problem at their level. But when they can't, then they, what is called nowadays, escalate the problem. Escalate the problem means that if the problem cannot be solved at this level of authority, you take it to a higher level of authority. So problem escalation is done. So the word escalate can mean to make the problem more complicated, or to take the problem to a higher level so that it can be given greater attention. So Bhumi Devi, along with she goes to Devata, then escalates the problem. Oh, the three rulers are not able to deal with it. Let's go to Devatas. Devatas, they go to Brahma. And then Brahma goes to Vishnu. So taking something to Vishnu is the highest level of escalation. It's like, say, if we have a company, if we have a mobile which is not working, so we may go to the local showroom. And the local showroom people are not able to solve it, then we tell, escalate it to the technical staff. And then we take it to the technical staff and they say, then if they are not able to solve it, take it to the supervisor. And then sometimes we may get in contact with, we are in India, we may get in contact with some
some executive in America who is maybe a chief engineer of research or something like that with respect to that product. We tell this is a problem. So now to escalate to higher and higher levels, it's not easy to get to those higher levels. And one needs to go through the right channels. So if we ourselves call, we won't be able to, if we call say Apple showroom, we can't reach the top Apple engineer. But if we go through the Apple showroom, if we go to the local Apple showroom and they call, and then the problem is escalated, they can reach the highest level. So now similarly, so how is Krishna reached? Krishna is reached not directly by some people in the earth who are in trouble. Yes, they can call, but the authorized way of reaching them is through Brahma's prayers. So now in the Bhagavatam, there the backstory is told right at the beginning. How the Bhagavatam describes Krishna's appearance is, in the last chapter of the 9th canto is a summary of Krishna's pastimes. Full pastimes are described in brief in just one chapter. And then Parikshit Maharaj requests, please describe in detail. And then Shukadeva Goswami starts describing. But in the Ramayana, actually the backstory is told at the end in Uttarakhand. And there the terrorist activities of Ravana and others are described. The backstory is told, is hinted at in the Ramayana in the beginning, when it's described about how Bhumi Devi, she also goes up and she says how Ravana is terrorizing. So in that sense, the problem escalation happens at both in both stories. That in the case of Ravana terrorizing the earth, and in the case of Kamsa and others terrorizing the earth. Now the difference is in these cases that Ram, is there any direct prophecy that Ram is going to appear? Yes, at one level when the devatas say that devatas appeal to Brahma and Brahma appeals to Vishnu, the Lord says this, I will decide. So in that sense it's similar, but at the earthly level there is no direct prophecy, at least no direct public prophecy. Later on, when Vishwamitra wants to take Ram to the forest to kill Tataka and Maricha and Subahu, at that time Dashrath Maharaj thinks, oh, Ram is just my 16-year-old son, how will he be able to fight against these demons? So at that time Vasishtha, who is the family priest of the Raghuvamsha, he says that I had heard long ago from the sage Sanak Sujat that actually in your dynasty, on the performance of Ashwamedha yet, on the performance of a big sacrifice, you will have the son who will be appearing, who will be Vishnu. So that prophecy is there, but that prophecy is not prominently there. It's not like something which is known to everyone. In contrast, when Krishna appears, the prophecy is what actually drives the whole story. Not just drives the whole story, it actually dramatically alters the whole story. So how does that happen? At one level, if we see that in the Ramayana, there is no direct relationship between Ram and Ram's family and Ravana's family. They are not just two different dynasties, they are two different species. Manavas and Rakshasas are two different species. Now Kamsa may also sometimes be referred to as a Rakshasa, but he is more of a Asura in mentality than in physicality. His body is not that of a demon, his body is like a human being only. Now in some story, some later retellings of the Ramayana, sometimes it is depicted as if Sita is the daughter of Ravana, but this is not told in any of the authorized. Is that there is no hint of such a thing at all in the Valmiki Ramayana, nor is it told in any of the authorized retellings of the Ramayana. Sometimes later people bring about some twists in the story just to try to titillate their readers. So there is no relationship between the hero and the villain directly, not no biological relationship. But in the case of the
appearance of Krishna, there's a direct relationship. Kamsa, who is one of the main villains, he is the brother of Devaki. Now interestingly, Vishwachakri Thakur explains in his Sarar Darshini Tika that Kamsa and Devaki are not real brother sisters, they are cousins. But sometimes a joint family, depending on nature, depending on situation, sometimes cousins may become closer to each other than even real brother sisters. So although Kamsa and Devaki did not share the same father, Kamsa's father was Ugrasen and Devaki's father was Devak. They were brothers, so they were related. So, but still, Kamsa and Devaki were very close to each other. And Kamsa was even at that time considered to be like the unofficial leader of the family, because he was so powerful. So he was a powerful hero. Hero at that time he had not exhibited any demoniac skills, demoniac qualities, or he had not done anything demoniac. But when he heard from his from the Akashvani that you fool, the woman whom we are carrying is the person who is going to kill you. So when he heard this, at that time, the result was. So in the Ramdila, there is no public Akashvani that happens the way it happens in Krishna Lila. Sanatana Goswami, in his Vaishnava Poshanikrika, explains that the Akashvani is actually Devavani. It is actually the Devatas who are prompted by the Lord to speak such a thing. So that Kamsa's sinful activities will be accelerated, and thereafter he can be, the Lord will descend faster to punish him. Now, in fact, the Akashvani, Devavani, the way it comes is, it is not just information. Sometimes information itself can be provocative. Mm-hmm. Say for example, if you hear that there are communal riots in the city and the rioters are coming here to where we are, that information itself is provocative because there is imminent danger. But if that information is presented in such a way that, oh, there are rioters who are coming and what are you doing? You are wearing your bangles, doing nothing. You know, you should do something to protect yourself. So, for Kamsa, it's not just information. The eighth Ashtam Garbha, the eighth child in the womb, will kill you. He says that, oh Kamsa, you are such a fool that you are like a donkey carrying or driving in a chariot the same woman whose eighth son will kill you. It's one thing to be killed by an enemy. It's quite another thing to be killed by someone to whom we are doing good. So Kamsa feels not only threatened in terms of his life, but he feels threatened, he feels insulted in terms of his intelligence also by that Akashvani. And what is this? I am serving menially a woman who is going to beget the child who is going to kill me. So in the traditional culture, the mother-son bond is considered to be one of the most intimate bonds.
the idea is that not only has the son come from the body of the mother, but the mother,
so the mother not only nourished the son when she is inside, when the son is inside the womb, but also she is offering him milk after he comes out, and afterwards also she is the primary caregiver of the
son. So
often, in general, parents and often specifically the mother,
it is
parents also feel it subjectively also that their son becomes a great person, then that and they feel, yes, with the son's greatness I have become great. And other people also judge, if a son becomes a son does something bad, then that reflects bad on the entire family. So now when Kamsa hears this Akashvani, it's not just that he wants to protect himself by, and that's why he wants to kill Devaki. That is true. But more than that, the tone of the Akashvani is such that Kamsa feels as if Devaki, the person whom I was serving, she has betrayed me now. She is hosting my enemy in her womb. Or she will be hosting my enemy in her womb. And she is going to, in that sense, she has already colluded with the gods who want to kill me. And thus she has become my enemy. So his anger is not just for what is going to come out of Devaki's womb later, but also what that coming out represents. That coming out represents that Devaki has become his enemy. So when he tries to kill Devaki, as we know, and Vasudev has to go into an emergency diplomatic rescue mission. He cannot use weapons against Vasudev, against Kamsa, because at one level Kamsa is far more formidable hero than Vasudev, and another level there are already many other family members, including the family ladies, who are there in the vicinity. And Vasudev doesn't want the bloodshed to spread in the family and further, especially for any of the other family ladies to be hurt. So he goes on he uses his expert diplomatic skills to persuade Kamsa. And Kamsa finally relents when Vasudev says that I will give all my 8 sons to you. So in this case, we see that Kamsa doesn't have to actually kill Devaki, but he wants to. That's a reflex action which reflects his innate nature. His nature is, you know, others matter when they matter to me. One level of self-centeredness is I only matter. Another level of self-centeredness is others matter as long as they matter to me. That means if they are of any help to me, good, then I will protect them. But if they are going to harm me anyway, then I will finish them. So, we see Vasudev and Devaki, they have to go through seeing 6 of their sons killed. And then even the 7th son, who they think is who they think gets a miscarriage. So basically, for parents to lose even one child is extremely distressing, especially for a mother after she has carried the child in her womb for so many months. Now even when the mother has not seen the child, even after that, if there is a miscarriage, there is so much pain. And nowadays there is this whole propaganda that abortion is just tissue removal. But even the mothers actually come to know that what that, it was not just a tissue, it was a child. And afterwards often
they go through severe regrets and they get psychological problems, apart from, after, of course, biological issues that come up because of abortion. These are not talked about much in the media. But the point is that from the moment of conception, a bond of affection is formed between the parents and their still unborn child, and especially between the mother and the child. And that bond grows stronger and stronger as the conception progresses towards delivery. So for a woman to carry a child through the full term of pregnancy and then after delivering to be helpless while the child is killed, but to see the child die even because of a natural disease is painful, but to see the child killed in front of one's own eyes, Kamsa, is so brutal that he doesn't just kill Devaki's sons, but he kills them in front of her eyes. To make a mother see the brutal death of her own son, it requires a terrible level of barbarousness in a person to inflict that kind of suffering on a mother. But Kamsa does that. And so 6 times Devaki has to see, then 7 times she has to undergo the agony of feeling that her son has, she has had a miscarriage. And all along there is also the fear that the 8th child, how will this 8th child escape? So both Dashrath and his wives on one side and Vasudev and Devaki on the other, both have to go through different kinds of sacrifices in order to get a son. But for getting Krishna, Vasudev and Devaki have to go through a huge level of privation. Privation means great amount of misery. They are imprisoned, they are tormented, they are humiliated. Now, one of the often in stories, in any good play, there is something called foreshadowing. Foreshadowing means, suppose at the beginning of a story, it's told, oh, there was a revolver in the drawer in the place where the meeting is going to be held. So then that indicates, if a good novelist, that novelist tells that there is a revolver, then that revolver should be used sometime later. Otherwise that revolver being mentioned makes no point constructive. Now sometimes just the mention of a revolver right at the beginning, it foreshadows the events that are going to happen later. So now in the case of Krishna, there is a foreshadowing that happens. And what is the foreshadowing? That Lord, that Ram actually is Dharmaraj, he is Dharmagupt, he is Dharmavit. In the Ramayana, there is one verse which uses the word Dharma and describes Ram in terms of Dharma using 6 different epithets for him. So that is especially when Ram, when Kaushalya, his mother is telling him that you should not go to the forest, because your mother's order is that you should not go to the forest. And the mother's order is more important than the father's order. So at that time, this Valmiki Rishi uses this multiple epithets to describe Ram, and he says that he knows Dharma. So now, of course, the Lord always knows Dharma, whether it's in the form of Ram or Krishna. But Ram is characterized usually by upright behavior. No matter what happens, Ram will always honor his word. And that's why he
when his father says that
Bharat will become the king and Ram will go to the forest, Ram immediately goes to the forest. So in the case of Krishna, Krishna is also upright Kshatriya, but he is not just upright, he is actually right in a way that takes people up. That means he sometimes may speak things which are right beyond right, which may not seem right to our mundane vision, but they are right from the point of view of ultimate benediction that those things bring. And that Krishna's right beyond right, Krishna's transcending worldly morality for the purpose of ultimate morality, that is foreshadowed in his birth. And how is that? That is, that this is Krishna will later speak one thing which seems to be true but which it turns out is not exactly true. This is like Krishna says, I will never raise weapons. And then he raises a wheel to attack Bhishma and protect Arjuna. So like that, we see that sort of things which are repeatedly depicted in the Mahabharata war especially, they are foreshadowed by in Vasudev's transcending his promise to Kamsa. So after the first seven sons are born and either they die for whatever way, when the eighth child appears, now Vasudev, he sees the child. There's a whole long story over there about how when he appears, first he appears in a 400 form, then changes to a 200 form. And while in the 400 form, both Vasudev and Devaki offer great fervent prayers to Krishna. And thereafter, Vasudev and Devaki, especially Devaki, request Krishna to change to a 200 form so she was actually might be able to hide him. Now, at one level, it might seem that if Devaki understands that Krishna is God and the way she has just offered all the prayers to Krishna, she doesn't understand he is God. Then if he is God, he is truly Vishnu. Vishnu is the protector of all the worlds. And why should Devaki at that time be fearful? If she knows Krishna is the protector of all the three worlds, then Krishna will be her protector also. And yet, she feels fearful. And significantly, she feels fearful not for herself, but for her baby. And she says, if you are like an ordinary child, I might be able to hide you. But if you are in this extraordinary 400 form, I will not be able to hide you. Actually, speaking, if you see that even if she is in 200 form, they are in a prison, and there's no way that she will be able to hide even in 200 form, a child with two hands. So her request doesn't seem to make sense either way. Means firstly, if she understands Krishna's position, then there is no need for her to think that I have to protect Krishna, that he's going to be the protector of the whole world, of the whole universe. And if at all she wants to protect Krishna, whether the child has four hands or two hands, what difference is it going to make? Because if you say that, somebody says that, oh, if she has four hands, then if the child has four hands, then surely people will, Kamsa will know that this child is really Vishnu and Kamsa will kill. But if he has two hands, then maybe Kamsa will not kill. But then we see that the earlier child had two hands, all the earlier children had two hands, and still Kamsa killed them. So in that sense, there is no guarantee that Kamsa will protect. Or Kamsa will not protect, he will protect, Kamsa will spare. So, what happens here is that there is a conflict between the Aishwarya and the Madhurya. Although, with the word Madhurya, sometimes we use it for the sake of Rasa, as the topmost of conjugal affection. Which is true, but Madhuri also means basically intimacy. So there is the awe-inspiring knowledge-centered conception of Vishnu as the supreme protector, and there is the intimacy-inducing
conception of Krishna as my child. So when she's in the mode of offering prayers, at that time the Aishwarya Bhav is prevalent. But as soon as the prayers get over, when the Yogamaya comes into the picture, when the Yogamaya comes in, then she says, "Oh Krishna, please appear. Please come in a two-handed form so that I might be able to conceal you." But there we see a glimpse of the affection of Yashoda, affection that Yashoda has for Krishna. We see a glimpse of that in the way, Devaki is caring for and calling for Krishna to conceal his extraordinary form. So then after that, Krishna himself tells Vasudeva that you take me to Nanda Maharaj's place. So it's interesting that Krishna, he tests Vasudeva's faith in one sense. Vasudeva is known as a very truthful person. In fact, he has such a reputation for truthfulness that even Kamsa agrees to his words. When Kamsa says, Vasudeva tells Kamsa that I'll give my all the sons that I get to you. So Kamsa accepts that. And now Vasudeva could have said that, "Oh, I have given my word to Kamsa. How can I let you go? So Kamsa, Vasudeva could have said like that, but Vasudeva doesn't say like that. Why is that? Because Vasudeva understands that there is a principle higher than morality. And that is spirituality. That is spiritual morality. So yes, in our normal dealings we do need to be moral. But when it ultimately comes to the pleasure of the Lord, when it comes to carrying out the will of the Lord, if we get explicit instruction, which is for ultimate good and which is transcending the principles of morality, then for the sake of the Lord we need to give up morality also. And that surrender. So one of the most challenging instructions, challenging not just in terms of difficulty to execute, but challenging in terms of even difficulty to understand, to comprehend. One of the most challenging instructions Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita is Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. It's one level to say that we should give up adharma for the sake of God, but it's another level to say that we should give up dharma for the sake of God. So ultimate religion means to pure law means to give up everything else for the sake of God. Both adharma and dharma. So that theme which Krishna demonstrates is the culmination of love. Whether it is in the case of you Arjuna as being willing to shoot the arrow toward Jayadrath even when the sun seems to have already set, or whether it is Yudhishthir's telling Drona that Ashwatthama is dead, or whether it is the gopis coming out late at night to respond to Krishna's flute song. So all these are incidences where the devotees are giving up not just adharma for the sake of coming to Krishna, for the sake of pleasing Krishna, but they are giving up dharma. And this is the summit of love. So that summit of love where, you know, it's said that we should give up the bad for the sake of the good. That is important. But sometimes the good can become the worst enemy of the best. The good can become the worst enemy of the best means that we become so attached to the good that we close our minds and close our eyes to the prospect of the best. So this is said that sometimes people do important things and they get so much caught in the important things that they forget the most important things. So for example, we may have many important worldly responsibilities and they are good, they are important. It's much, much better to be responsible materially than to be irresponsible materially. But even more important is to be also spiritually responsible, to act in our relationship with Krishna. But when we don't act that way and we let the good come in the way of the best, then we cheat ourselves. So one of the most dramatic messages that Krishna is going to teach is that we should be willing to give up the bad for the sake of God, and we should be willing to give up the good for the sake of God. Because God is the best.
and that willingness to give up the good for the sake of the best, which is going to be a consistent teaching of Krishna and a consistent example demonstrated by Krishna's devotees, that is demonstrated at the time of his appearance by Krishna's asking Vasudev, and Vasudev is agreeing to put aside his word to Kamsa so that Krishna is able to go to Vrindavan. So in this way, Lord Ram, he demonstrates dharma in a very standard and upright way, and that is important. But real life is real life situations are often much more convoluted. Convoluted means they are complex, they are intricate, and it's not easy to know what is to be done and what to be done. We can't have a pat formula. We can't have pat answers. We can't have straight formulas for dealing with life. And that's why ultimately the intention to serve, the intention to please, that is extremely important for our understanding what is to be done ultimately. And Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam Ye Namam Upayantite, Krishna says, if we have the devotional disposition, then Krishna will give us the intelligence for what is to be done. So that example, that point is demonstrated in Krishna's appearance by his asking Vasudeva and Devaki to give up their son, to give Vasudeva especially, to give up his truthfulness for the sake of his devotion. And in our life also, at one level, when we follow the four regulative principles, we are giving up the bad for the sake of Krishna. But along with that, we may also have to give up the good. That means sometimes our family members, our friends, they may oppose our bhakti. And sometimes we may have to displease them, sometimes we may have to alienate them. Of course, we shouldn't be insensitive with them, and we can try to explain as nicely as possible why we are doing what we are doing. But beyond that, sometimes we have to hurt them. And certainly, we should be as sensitive as possible. Still, sometimes we may have to give up the good for the sake of the best. So, if we are in bad association and we give that up for the sake of Krishna, that is good. But if sometimes there is good association which may be sattvic, but which may not be spiritual, then we may feel, what is wrong with this? Yes, there is nothing directly wrong with it. The wrong is that it is replacing the best with the good. So, sattva guna cannot liberate us from material existence. It is bhakti alone that can liberate us from material existence. So, truthfulness is a good virtue, but truthfulness is no substitute for pure love. And Krishna descends to this world to demonstrate his pastimes of pure love. Pure love that is beyond worldly distinctions of good and bad. And when the Bhagavad Gita states that, understanding the appearance and activities of Krishna, we will not come back to this world. What that essentially means is that when we truly understand the selfless love that underlies the Lord's descent to this world, his selfless love for all of us which makes him come to this world, his selfless love which inspires him to, which animates his loving reciprocation with his devotees, then we will also feel inspired to enter into this world of selfless love. And by entering into that world of selfless love, we can get the supreme happiness. So it is to give us a glimpse of that sublime world of selfless love that the Lord descends to this world. And when we understand that, then vetti tattva taha, when we understand it through that in truth, then taktva deham punarjanma naiti mameti suharjuna. Now we will return back to Krishna. Thank you very much. Krishna Janmashtami Mahamahotsav ki jai.